Hello, everyone. Happy fall. I'm John Palfrey, and very, very, very glad to be kicking off this Tuesday Lunch Series event and welcoming back one of our hometown boys, Jonathan Zittrain, for his first return to the Berkman Lunch Series since he came back as a professor of law here at HLS. He's very kindly opened things up in a broad Jonathan-like way to talk about his book, The Future of the Internet, but in a way that will have a direct application to one of the projects that we're working on right now at the Berkman Center, and to bring you all into the conversation. So more on that in a moment. But for everybody who is new here at the Berkman Center, welcome. Every Tuesday we do this. It's a very open format. We're going to go around in a second, introduce ourselves to one another. Jonathan will then take over from there. It's all being recorded and webcast. Please do speak on the record, but if you prefer not to be on the record for posterity, then don't. And Jonathan, you were...
I don't know why I wanted to get in while I'm chewing, but...
Right. Usually it's the moderator who calls on someone who is chewing at that moment to say something. It's very rarely the person who waves their hand.
Totally self-inflicted
room. I was trying to fill in.
Thank you. I know. I appreciate that.
There's also a nice spot next to Esther Artai, who's quite a wonderful person, and if you would like to sit next to her, it would be a treat.
Very well done. Thank you.
All right. Good. I'm going to sit down now.
No. I was going to suggest that in the spirit of, depending on your proclivities, we are the change we've been waiting for or ready to lead. I'd like to suggest that as we go around and introduce, our agenda is to figure out some of the issues that will be percolating in the coming year in the field of internet and law and policy and tech and all that. So as you introduce, if there's something you want to add about it without it becoming a PowerPoint deck, I'll handle that part. Please add something, and I will keep track up here as we go, and we may very well set our own agenda ourselves. So that's what I was going to suggest for the introductions, and back over to you, JP, to
awesome.
Lead the intros.
I think Professor Benkler should start us off with
his... I'm the focused idea.
Sorry. All right, perfect. See, it's going to be fast, Jonathan.
Yochai Benkler, I teach here and hang out here, and I have the focused idea that we should be doing.
What about you? What are you focused on at the moment, Yochai?
What am I focused on? Focus is the wrong word.
All right, cooperation, for instance?
Cooperation, trying to look at the foundations of cooperation, working with a group of people from around the university every week on cooperation, who are doing cooperation in various models, ranging from experimental work with the program on evolutionary dynamics and with computer science to a program on case studies that some of us here are working on, to collaborating with John and Oliver on the Law Lab, which includes itself several foci, including building an experimental platform online, playing with media and democracy, which I'm sure we'll hear more, doing some more empirical work on the blogosphere. Broadly speaking, trying to look at the micro foundation of cooperation, how we move from understanding that cooperation is important online to what sort of design manipulation in systems will achieve better cooperation, and trying to get a better handle on what the internet actually means for democracy.
That's the year's worth of work.
And name us a few examples of cooperation gone good on the net. What are some shining examples?
Cooperation gone good? I don't know, do we have? Did any of them work? Wikipedia?
True professor, let's do his research.
Yelp.
Yelp.
What do we want? What are we looking for? Are we looking for things that aren't the obvious? Things that aren't the obvious?
Just enough to flesh it out. That's Wikipedia, Yelp.
TripAdvisor.
Facebook,
different kind of, sorry?
So far, all these things have in common that they make no money.
Is this a bad thing?
No, not at all. Just a common thing.
Well, so part of the problem is I've just spent all morning trying to come up with a typology. And now I'm basically swimming in what counts. So if you want certain things that make money, Amazon Mechanical Turk, which may or may not be making money. It's not obvious that it is. Yahoo Answers probably isn't. On the other hand, different kinds of cooperation in the sense of people being willing to actually pay. So if you want to go to Jonathan Colton's website.
But this is an example of cooperation, Mechanical Turk.
Well, it's an interesting question. It's an example of a particular effort to harness distributed work in a way that only when it's coordinated and collated does it have an output. It is often described as cooperation. I'm a little skeptical about whether it should count as cooperation, but it's within the realm of things people broadly put in under peer production. And so one of the things that we're trying to do is map, what do we think, about 1,500 to 2,000 sites along various dimensions of what, how they will play out. And one of the dimensions is what is the motivation for participation and whether it's money. And so Amazon Mechanical Turk is an example of somebody who's trying to harness distributed work through paying money.
Got it. I like this one. Rewrite sentences in your own words. No qualifications required. 5 cents per human intelligence task. There are 880 of them available. All spelling and grammar must be correct. And I guess you read a paragraph and then you rewrite it. It must be something that's designed to avoid copyright infringement claims or homemade word salad.
Or to fool teachers on plagiarism.
It's how to rewrite term papers so that they'll get past Turnitin.com.
Exactly.
Or spam bots.
See, this is the upside of peer production. And it's what amazes me about these is you don't even know who your employer is. It could well be Dr. Evil. So,
and what's your point?
I'm just keeping things flowing along. Speaking of which, Catherine Bracey.
Catherine Bracey, from staff, and it's entirely unfair that I have to call you okay. So I'm just going to pass along.
John Klibinger, I'm a fellow here and a co-director of the Law Lab. And in the Law Lab, we study things like cooperation, reputation, systems, identity, and very interested in sort of how we develop new kinds of what we call digital institutions that reflect sort of informal ways of which the people can govern themselves. And looking at things like reputation systems. So reputation system is one area that I'm particularly interested in. And how do you build robust reputation systems? Because that's a key mechanism of governance.
And is your vision of reputation systems one in which there's kind of one ring to rule them all, one ring to bind them,
or
it's like there's just lots of
reputation? Yeah, there's one reputation. No, there are multiple contexts.
So I might have a crappy reputation on eBay, but over on Amazon, I'm gold.
Yeah, or different contexts. I mean, and is a reputation something that someone takes with them? Is it something they control or someone else controls? I mean, with a whole set of issues around that. And is it reputation based upon other peer ratings, or is it based upon your behavior? I mean, so there are many types of reputation systems that that you have, and there's contextual.
Got it.
Hi, my name is Andres Monroy. I'm a PhD student at the Media Lab at MIT. And I've been working on, actually, I will list it as one of the places where you can find cooperation, as Scratch. It's an online community for kids to share programs that they create, interactive media that they create, from video games to interactive art to stories. I've been leading the development of the community, and basically people have the access to this programming environment that is kind of Lego blocks based, where they can build these kind of creations and share them on the community. And the original source code is always there. So people often download the original source code for one of these projects, and they make their own version of it, and they upload their version back to the site. So about 15% of the projects on the community are remixes of other projects. We have about 200,000 projects now in the past 15 months uploaded by people from different parts of the world and different ages.
So it's like SourceForge for kids.
Exactly, yeah.
SourceForge Junior.
Yep.
The little SourceForge. Got it.
Yeah.
Smurfs Forge. I'm still thinking it through.
Keep going.
Yeah. No, it's great.
You apparently want to focus on rebranding.
But you never know with these digital natives. So, yes.
I'm Mélanie Dulon. I'm a Berkman Fellow. I'm working on the open access side of copyright for librarians and universities. And actually, this month, I'm celebrating my 5th year of involvement with Creative Commons friends. So, well, I understand why people contribute to the Commons and share their works. I'm just wondering why I'm continuing working for free on the top of all my other projects for Creative Commons since so long. And I guess it's because it's fun and rewarding, and I meet nice people.
Just keep telling yourself that. What's the biggest issue facing Creative Commons France?
Collecting societies.
Collecting societies. Yeah. Threat or menace?
Both.
Yeah, that was right.
Yeah.
Hobson's choice there.
Yeah. Tough question.
And it's that they don't like the idea of people choosing to give away their stuff for free because then there's no VIG to collect off what they put through the collecting societies?
No, that's more complicated because we suggest that they would just collect the commercial royalties after using a Creative Commons non-commercial option, which is...
So if you put out something Creative Commons non-commercial, people can use it freely so long as it's non-commercial, whatever that means. And then if Disney stumbles upon it and says, this would be perfect for our theme park, they need to go back to the author or creator. And the collecting societies would be a part of that in your view or not?
Well, in my view, they would be the perfect middleman's institution.
Yeah.
But no.
Oh.
No, it doesn't work. They're not ready for that. They don't understand that you would pay for something you can get in another way for free. And I guess that other institutions will be much more efficient to manage those site contracts such as Jamendo or Dogmazic.
Got it.
Hi, I'm Jen Gordon. I work over at Langdell.
You might have to pipe up because
I'm Jen Gordon. I work over at Langdell. I'm John Palfrey's assistant over there.
Great.
I'm Harry Lewis. I'm a computer science professor here and a faculty Berkman Fellow, and I just had my pupils dilated, which is why I've got my...
But you're also very cool. We weren't going to ask.
And I'm actually teaching. I'm teaching a course in the Extension School called Life, Liberty, and Happiness After the Digital Explosion, which is based on the book that Hal Abelson, Ken Ledeen, and I.
And is this your book?
Blown to Bits.
No, that's the other one.
There are two Blown to Bits books.
Yeah, the other one's the other one's.
It didn't seem like it was like the only winner is the consumer. That did not sound like you.
That's an HBS. Book, yeah. Book and that was a.
I like this one. Adding richness is the most powerful way to forestall deconstruction. I think they have not forestalled deconstruction. Deconstruction has already overtaken their book.
Yes, one of the things that I learned about intellectual property in the course of writing this book is that
you can't copyright a title.
Copyrightable, yes. I had the title.
So wait, isn't this like a disaster?
We'd actually the whole book was written with flood metaphors. It was all going to be digital floods and gates, dams bursting, and so on, and then
category four,
bright
colon.
Idea to know it should be explosive metaphors. We were going to call it Blown to Bits. And so I went through it, you know, at the last month, and I went through and rewrote all of the water metaphors with dynamite metaphors.
Google actually has a translator for
and
that.
And then we went to try to claim the URL and discovered that there was another book by the same title. But we just
have you talked to those guys?
Through counsel.
Was that in reply to them or launching? Wow, that is.
No, they're smart enough to know that they had no legal claim, but they were not amused.
Extraordinary.
This is all being broadcast, isn't it? Oh, well.
That's part of the new deconstructed world. We can't forestall it.
One of the things that I'm doing this fall is putting together an undergraduate major in technology and society, for which digital technologies would be kind of one third. You know, there would also be energy and biomedicine would probably be the other major areas. And
wow.
One of the
subtitle: Make a Million, Save the Planet.
Yeah. So one of the initial challenges is going to be to figure out if there is enough. You know, what are the common threads on the quote unquote social side that people should know about, so that we can create an introductory course that will serve all three audiences, or indeed the freshmen who don't know which audience they might actually want to be interested in. You know, so a course that's got some economics, some law, some other sorts of social science in it that's relevant to the application of technology to problems of society. And then you know, like with some case studies from each area or something like that, so that in the second year people can then channel themselves in one part or another. Right. And then we've got to structure, you know, what the whole set of major requirements, and get our faculty to agree that it's a liberal arts degree and various other things like that.
Got it.
So I need help on that, and I will be consulting.
I'm Jill York, and I'm Berkman's staff. Vandana Aneja, Berkman's staff. I'm project manager on Verdict, so verdict.org, and which is a bunch of tools.
And what are your Stein comments on this one?
My Stein comment on this one is the icon for Herdict is a herd of sheep. Here are some of the sheep over there, and yet sheep come in flocks, so it really should be called flock-dict. That's pretty snide, isn't it? Yeah. What do you say to that, Vandana?
heard through the grapevine that it would be rejected in Germany. So one of the biggest challenges that I'm going to be thinking about is how to get more and more people to sign up to contribute to this digital awareness and their experiences with technology and in the digital world.
Got it.
And Yoka, you really expected him to critique his own project online here?
Yeah.
I'm Persephone Yale. I'm a fellow at the Center with the Media Republic Project at MediaRepublic.org. And trying to finalize a bunch of documents and conclusions about how the shifting media landscape in the digital media age is or isn't doing everything that we need the news media to do, and what kind of new institutions we might need to make it do that.
So at the risk of putting you on the spot, if I'm the editor of the New York Times, yes, what news do you have for me?
You should be doing more to educate your consumers and linking more to other people.
Link more to other people.
But I don't have the answer for how you're going to. It's not clear to me how you're going to make. I think the New York Times is going to be fine, personally.
Uh huh.
The other thing.
Question is. Yeah.
Got it.
The question is whether the New York Times is doing everything that we need. That's what.
Gotcha. I don't know how to put that into a bullet point, but future of old media in a new media world or something like that, even though we're all immediately going to reject the use of such terrible phrases as world and in. Right. No, I got it. And we might return to that if we have time. In fact, John Palfrey has extensive notes that he's prepared to present on this issue.
No.
So.
It's a note for you to read when I leave the room for yourself.
Oh. Well, do you want? Why don't you leap? Why don't we? Let's take a break in our intros.
This is too good. This is too good.
You sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Sorry that I have to jump out at one. Oh, that's in 10 minutes. Okay. I'm going to have Google translate this in the meantime. Steve.
So I'm Steve Schultz. I'm a relatively new fellow here at the center, working primarily on a project called Media Cloud, which aims to slurp in the content of every piece of news available on the web. Yes, we don't have much of a web presence at the moment. At the moment, we're operating under the radar.
This is a stealth project to suck the web.
All news
to produce substance rather than appearance.
Whoa! Snap!
Yes.
Tell us more about Media Cloud.
We didn't invite these two back.
In any event, it's partly an effort to do more quantifying around some of the types of research questions a lot of folks here have related to the internet and media and how the internet is changing media or how things like mainstream media and peer production interact with each other. And then secondarily, I'm interested broadly in questions of policy making and technology openness, getting into things like spectrum and neutrality and things like that. And then a third, even further side interest at the moment has to do with openness of court or openness and accessibility of court documents. So if I were trying to draw a thread through the three of those, which is perhaps a little bit challenging, and tie it into forthcoming internet issues, I think it would relate to the extent to which we can quantify or put hard terms around the value of what flows from the network when a lot of that is very squishy. And so can we quantify what the news flows are? Can we quantify how innovation and openness benefit society and the economy as a whole? And when it comes to things like government documents that are often closed off, even though they're technically open to the rest of the public, how do we quantify the benefits of opening that versus the costs? So trying to start to put some terms around how we value those things and use that as a way of making policy arguments for particular actions.
Got it. And just one click back on Media Cloud, what would you say the one of the major questions it's trying to address is?
Well, I should say that it's fundamentally a tool that should be able to ask a lot of different questions. I'll give you two specific data points. One would be trying to understand where stories come from and tracking those stories or those memes over time, so we can answer questions about do stories start in the blogosphere or in the mainstream media. Another set of questions revolves around what are different sources paying attention to, either globally in terms of what areas of the world are getting news attention and for what reasons, or what the mixture of topics is between different news sources and what that tells us and how we can characterize different news sources quantitatively based on this.
Got it.
I'm Erica George. I'm Berkman staff. I work on the Stop Badware project, which Jonathan is a director of. I don't know if you want me to talk.
Go for it.
I'm going to let Max do that. But so Stop Badware is a our project trying to stop badware, malware, etc. And we kind of operate on Jonathan's theory of using the community to help try to combat some of the bad side effects of the otherwise wonderfully open internet. And I don't know how much.
That's good so far. Badware. Did they get rid of Stop Badware or not?
Oh, Stop Badware? Yeah. We love this site. We actually Berkman,
they did seem to use our logo there in a brazen act.
We know the people who do this. So
they probably work here, don't they?
No, but They're friends.
Welcome to the only site making money on the web.
We were actually also thinking that that Berkman should start a startgoodwear.org, and
would we run
it could be the Berkman clothing line.
I got to say, just to make somebody very excited, let's click on the sponsored link. Somewhere somebody's like, we got a live one, we got a live one.
Oliver. Hi, I'm Oliver Goodenough. I teach law at Vermont Law School, and I'm a faculty fellow here and one of the co-directors on the Law Lab that you've heard a fair bit about. And I'm particularly interested in digital institutions in an economic context. But my question, you've heard a lot about that. My question for the future of the web is, what is the successor when copyright dies?
Ooh.
There is a presumption within that question, right?
Do you have a doctrine in mind?
No, actually, I've only recently come to the fully convinced conclusion that copyright is I think there's the term marcescent, which is when a leaf is on the tree, it's dead, but it doesn't know it, and it hasn't fallen off.
Wait, so if you take nothing away from this lunch, marcescent?
Yes.
I'm not spelling it right. How do you spell it?
I'm not sure I can spell it.
Marcescent
seems
to be right.
Did they teach it in Vermont? One of those great terms for something that's dead but doesn't know it yet.
If the term only has 99 hits on Google, it's
pretty obscure.
How many more hits will it get today alone?
Oh, marcescent. There we are. Crowdsourcing it. All right.
This is how you know it exists.
That's right. That's right. The retention of dead plant organs that normally are shed.
Jonathan, can you log in and put CF copyright somewhere in there?
Let's see if Oliver's already done it. Okay, you think that copyright is the walking dead. It is marcescent, just like that tree pictured there. When will we actually know it's dead? Is it when Title 17 is repealed?
What a good question. No, I don't think we'll know before then, but we'll know. We need to know what new buds look like, and we don't know that yet. So that's my question.
Uh-huh.
Is there no term for that?
No,
I'm not. Go back to your mom. It's called common sense. Okay.
Well, who knew?
Who knew?
I'm Brent Webster. I'm a master's student in East Asian Studies. And what I'm interested in terms of the future of the internet is, you know, there's a lot of talk about the online censorship in China. And I found that there's a bit of a disconnect between the way we talk about it and the way Chinese internet users talk about it, and the way a lot of Chinese internet users don't talk about it. They'll simply say something like, this website didn't work. And then a lot of users will talk about it, and they'll talk about circumvention methods. So I'm interested in those differences and what they mean for civil society in China or international understanding between China and other countries.
And what you forgot is that you just returned from, is it 2 years?
One
year. 1 year in China.
Yeah. You get really obsessed with internet censorship when you're behind one of those walls.
And what's your, having spent a year in China, what's your working hypothesis? That the people are so conditioned to the censorship that they don't like to think of it as the government nannying them?
I don't think I can advance a hypothesis, but I have found that fewer people than I would have expected, even at elite universities and global companies, even knew that they were being censored. And I also think that a lot of concerns that it might restrict civil society activities may be misplaced, because people who are innovators in civil society tend to also be heavy users of things like encrypted email, Tor, the many circumvention methods that people know about. China hasn't bothered to block a site called proxy4china.com. That's the number 4 if you're interested. But, you know, so there are these holes. It's a very permeable...
Number 4.
That's what you said.
It's a very permeable way, wall, if it's to be called that. Oh. And, you know, the people who want to get through tend to get through. Oh.
Looks like they're already gone.
They disappear every
this
now
is
and then.
A parking
this
page.
This happened a few months ago. And then they came back. So we'll see what happens.
I'll just keep reloading in the meantime.
Let me know when you get it.
Yeah, okay then. Esther.
Hi, I'm Esther Hargitay. I'm a new fellow. I'm on the faculty at Northwestern in the Communication Studies Department, my PhD in sociology. I teach classes like Internet and Society, so it would be that part of that potential major.
What's the title of your class, though? I'll bet it sounds much more academic.
Internet and Society.
snap. I set myself up for that one. I like how, though, if you Google just your first name, it's you.
It's me.
That's pretty cool.
Indeed. Have had that since 98. It's not as obscure a spelling as it seems. There are a lot of Esters spelled that way in Hungary.
They just don't have web pages.
Yeah. Some of them do. Some of them are celebrities, so now I have to fight pretty hard to keep this status. Okay, regarding future of the internet, what concerns me most is making sure that it doesn't result in increased inequalities in the population as opposed to where we are now or where we were 10 years ago. So I'm working on a book project this year, and the argument's going to be, or the argument is, that in fact, if anything, okay, despite what we had hoped for the internet and the great hopes we have for the internet to alleviate inequalities, if anything, it's going to make and is making things worse than we had before. And while everyone may be a little bit better off potentially, the differences are widening, and thus the potential larger inequalities. So,
is digital divide a good handle for this, or are there problems with that
term? Not a great term. Digital divide mainly addresses the question of access versus no access. It's very much a binary term, a dichotomous term, whereas I argue that even once people gain access, there are going to be a lot of differences among them because their skills are going to differ, they're going to do different things while they are online, and ultimately they're going to benefit differently from what they do online. And then another thing that I won't be doing too much directly on, but will be thinking about a lot, is use of mobile devices for data collection in the future. I just got a grant from Nokia to think about this. Just last night, downloaded a really awesome little program to my Nokia N95 that acts as a pedometer. So now I don't have to just wear my analog pedometer, but I have this one that just comes with me all the time anyway. So it's pretty cool, and yep, that's the one.
Does it call you if you're walking too slowly?
So anyway, that's another thing I'll be thinking about. But generally speaking, actually methods of data collection about people's digital media uses is something I think about a lot.
And I write that the Nokia N95 is an open, so-called generative system, mm-hmm. in the sense that mm-hmm. you can run any software from anywhere. You can go to this random web page and get it.
Yep. Indeed.
Are there Nokia N95 worms and viruses yet?
That I don't know.
Or is its diminishingly small market share not worth it?
Well, in the U.S., it's a pretty small... It's not diminishing. In the U.S., it's a fairly small market share. Nokia is huge in Europe, for example. I mean, there are millions in use, but that's obviously a relatively small market share.
Right.
But I highly recommend it, although I realize I'm getting money from them, so now that's sort of a weird thing to say.
So we should add research ethics to our forthcoming internet issues. Yeah, okay, we got that. Great. That's right. There's just, were you on that? You were one of the authors of that paper, weren't you?
What, on research ethics?
On research ethics. There was just a paper on that.
No,
oh, well. Different paper.
I should read it, though, I guess.
Yes. I'll forward you the link. It's a little late now. Gene.
Gene Koo, I'm a fellow here. I'm hoping this month to be announcing the launch of eLangDell, which is the commons for law professors to share their teaching materials. I'm also working on a chapter in a forthcoming book on video games and learning. The chapter will be about video games and moral education and character education. And I'm also working on another project where we're using virtual 3D technologies to help neighborhoods visualize public design and have more robust input into the public design process.
Wolf?
Yeah, I'm Wolf Richter, a doctoral student at the Oxford Internet Institute, currently visiting here at Berkman. I'm stuck in the middle of my PhD thesis on innovation in copyright law. So in my world, copyright law is not yet dead, but it's in urgent need of some innovation, of some overhaul. Have not explored the, was it Marcescency, the Marcescent features of...
The Marcescence.
Marcescence, so to say. Instead of essence, we have Marcescence, but I'm happy to continue and take this as my takeaway from this session.
And what's one of your big findings from your thesis in progress?
One of my big findings is, well, there is some hope, there are people innovating in this space, but I'm not quite sure if we can do completely without copyright law. So I've investigated the launch of the project, well, actually Terry Fisher's project in China last year, and it's quite interesting to see how the reception of some innovative solution to the copyright crisis is received in a country where it's obviously completely normal to get venture capital for stuff that in the US would be Pirate Bay kind of operations. And so, yeah, I'm still trying to figure out what that actually means in terms of public policy recommendation. But at the moment, I think even if there's something beyond copyright law, it will still have to be something that gives legal protection. We can't do without that.
I'm Chase Cook. I'm a former Berkman intern, now a, I guess, budding web-based software entrepreneur.
Can people back there hear? Yep, okay.
And I guess something that interests me pretty strongly is nexus of generativity, reuse, and aesthetics, and where I guess art and popular culture are going with respect to those ideas.
Can you give us an example?
I don't know, the rise of mashup artists, for instance, in music and increasingly in video as well, as those software tools.
So we can't resist but ask, what is your favorite mashup of the moment that we haven't heard of?
No, the new Girl Talk
album is
very good. I don't know.
The new Girl Talk album. Some agreeable nods around the table. Well, I wouldn't try. Yes.
I am Lachman. I'm a student fellow here at Berkman and also new. I am planning my dissertation here. I've long been interested in issues of defense censorship in China as well. But I decided to write about a less depressing topic. So I'm about the future of the internet. The thing I'm concerned is that we hopefully will not be soon be talking about the future of the internet, as in the fragmentation of the internet among different blogospheres, for example, that don't connect to each other anymore. So I'm interested in Global Voices and their work and how they try to bridge these spheres of the internet back together. For my dissertation, I'm interested in how Global Voices is changing its production as we know it. What does Global Voices tell us more about the state of journalism?
And by Global Voices, you're referring to the famed project by which people around the world can blog.
And
have their blog summarized by editors.
Contextualized, translated.
And other people who work for free.
Oh, no,
yeah, and I'm particularly interested in how Global Voices is, or how we can think, using Global Voices, how we can think about hospitality as a value, as a condition of the internet.
Hospitality.
People yes. On IRC are requesting people talk louder.
Hospitality.
They can hear fine. People around the edges of the room.
That was just downright rude of me.
Well, talking louder is more
it's
hospitable.
It's ironic that I was the word hospitality and I shouted.
I think mainstream media has been doing a traditionally pretty bad job if we think about hospitality, and Global Voices might be a better way to think about hospitality, and hospitality being defined as the ethical obligation to listen to the stranger or the other.
The ethical obligation to listen to a stranger or the other. So you mean as a form of dialogue and
yeah.
Rhetoric.
Right. I'm more interested in hospitality as mediated, not necessarily.
Got
and
it.
By the way, I want to thank Berkman for the hospitality for having me here. So.
We are listening carefully.
Hi, I'm Tuna Chatterjee. I'm a Berkman Fellow here. I'm staff attorney with the Citizen Media Law Project. And I can't think of any one forthcoming internet issue. There just seem to be so many. when it comes to the project that I'm working on, which is necessarily US focused for the time being. The biggest question perhaps is how are old media laws responding to new media? And that sounds really general and sorry about that, but if you want a...
No worries at all. We're hospitable here.
It's true.
Hi, Tim Huang. I'm part of Berkman staff.
Hi, my name is Adam. I'm just a student at the law school who wandered over to hear what all you guys are talking about. It's been very exciting so far.
So. We're going to keep coming back to you for like those dial updates during the debates. Like, where you get bored and where you don't.
I'll be here all week. So, thank you.
Hi, I'm Rob Farris. I'm the research director at the center.
Adam.
Oh, that's.
I have the pleasure and the opportunity to be involved in a lot of the projects that have been mentioned before. Internet censorship, surveillance, participatory media, internet democracy, media cloud, herdict. I'm one of the sheep that's inappropriately herding. My question for the internet, which I don't know how to answer, but maybe someone here has an idea on how I can start looking at this, is how online organizations and institutions will complement or substitute real life institutions and what that means. So, somewhat of a modest little question there with a couple sub-themes on there. One is, how does filtering and surveillance influence the creation of online institutions? And I think I'll leave it at that. One of the things I'm very excited about this fall is a Wednesday afternoon discussion session with Yochai and Bruce, which I'll let Bruce talk about, so I'll save some for you.
Do you want to put in a specific plug for that discussion session?
Yes, we do.
Sure. So Wednesday, open to the public. Sorry, Bruce Etling, director of the Internet and Democracy Project. Wednesdays, 5:30 to 7:30, or as long as we go on talking and drinking, whatever. We're going to be talking about all these topics within the Internet and Democracy realm. Sort of a broad brush. We'll talk about the case studies we've done, which includes the different blogospheres. Iranian, Russian, Arabic, Chinese, that we're getting onto next. Other examples of how activists have used technology. Just trying to answer these big questions about what's the impact of the internet on democracy, both overseas, but I think, you know, for me, I'm interested lately in domestically what's happening, and I'm kind of wondering if this Sarah Palin moment within the U.S. election right now is the one that we'll come back to and say, oh, this is where the bloggers really showed their value and sort of vetting the candidate for others, or if it's, well, actually, no, they just created this echo chamber that we criticized the cable news for, and it sort of hurt someone's chances being sort of trying to be independent on that. But anyway, so that's 5:30 to 7:30 on Wednesdays, and I think we'll start within the next week or two, but we'll have a big announcement about that.
Center?
Yep, right here in this room.
Does it start tomorrow or not?
No.
Great.
Okay.
My name is Dan, and I'm I'm a Berkman staff, and because no one's mentioned it yet, recommender systems and how they're evolving.
Recommender systems?
Yes.
So basically reputation systems for stuff, not just people.
Exactly.
Since I'm out of room, I'm going to add it there.
My name's Heidi. I'm a women fellow from China. Well, I'm happy that some people are interested in China, you know, the situation in China, but I don't think I have the answers to those questions. I'm here to learn and observe. I work for a Chinese publication, and as you know, the media industry here is kind of going down, but in China it's kind of booming, but still we are facing the same challenge, so.
It's not amplifying, it's just to the webcasters. So
okay.
You still have to shout.
That's all. Thank you.
My name is Jennifer Schabeter. I'm a doctorate student at the law school, and my dissertation is on the topic of the bridge between international organizations and regulatory agencies and the internet. So basically how the internet, social networks, and different, I guess, websites on the internet can be based, can be used to reinforce cooperation and get people engaged in domestic and international regulation. And the other topic would be online campaigns and fundraising. I've been especially focusing on the campaigns of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama that were done online.
Hi, I'm Amar Asher. I'm Berkman Center staff, and my question would be a variation or a slight spin on Clay Shirky's question of how would we, in what new ways will we organize without organizations in the future?
I'm Joris van Hoboek. I'm a visiting researcher from the Institute for Information Law from the Netherlands, and I'm working on search engine governance and. I'm very much interested also in the question of the application of old media laws to this kind of new entities. And I'm also very much interested in the governance of search and search engine, the organization of search engines, questions of decentralization versus centralization, and the dominance of Google, how is that going to work out in the future.
Yeah. And you're nervous about the dominance of Google then?
I'm not necessarily, no, I'm intrigued of how this is moving forward.
That's such a great word.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
Hey, my name's Dan Ray. I'm a second year law student, and I'm just here to hear all the interesting things you all have to say.
Yeah, I'm John Zhiqiang. Yeah, I think I'm a newcomer. Yeah, this year I'm doing research at Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies. Yeah, I'm a professor of Nanjing University. Yeah, now one of my research field is the piracy in contemporary China. So you can Google me, use my name and piracy and Nanjing University. You will be found more website about me. Yeah, thanks.
My name is John Pierce. I'm a software developer and entrepreneur working on the web, and I also run Beta House, which is a co-working space in Central Square. I guess one of the issues that I see as a current issue that impacts the future of the internet is the control that sort of the oligopoly of media companies and internet providers and cell phone carriers are exerting over innovation.
Wait, are you nervous about Google? Or only intrigued?
Am I? I still have some trust in Google. We'll see how well that shakes out. But we've seen things like Comcast and AT&T beginning to introduce sort of bandwidth limiting or tiered internet systems, and we all know about carriers and the kind of impact they have. So the U.S., for example, not to take a U.S.-centric view, but the U.S. is falling behind and has been for some time in technology and internet. Broadband internet, so I'm concerned about that.
The impact that it has on innovation.
I'm Jay. I run the web group here along with Erica, the blog group here with Erica, and I also work for a company that does really cool things with global internet router data, and we're also building a Web 2.0 site with a recommendation engine.
What's the company?
The company is called Renesis.
Nessus.
Renesis.
It's too much.
My name's Todd Huntley, and I'm an LLM student here at the law school.
I'm Max Weinstein. I manage the Stop Badware project, and one of the questions I think I'm really interested in right now is what are the appropriate roles for various parties on the internet in controlling badware, spam, malware, etc. And by parties, I mean ISPs, users, websites, domain registrars, et cetera. What are the appropriate roles? And within those roles, what are the appropriate approaches to exercising those roles in a way that protects people from the bad stuff while also protecting the rights and freedoms of the people who are doing the right thing?
So. How to do vigilantism right.
That's right.
Just like Batman.
I'm also Max, actually, Max Gladstone. I just got back from a couple years in China with the Yale China Association Fellowship. I'm interested in the long run in both the censorship and sort of great firewall issues that people have raised around the table, in piracy, and also in the way that the internet develops differently in different cultures. In China, for example, there's a lot more emphasis on sort of entertainment roles and much less on consumer user-provided news and information services than there is in the United States.
And did you share the sense that people maybe weren't even aware that filtering was happening or would describe it in ways that were oblique?
It depends very much on who you're talking to. Most of my students were aware that there was, for example, websites that they couldn't get to, but were shocked that there were subjects that, for example, I wasn't allowed to talk about in the classroom. So there are different levels, but then once you get to, once you start, it varies a lot depending on where you are in the country. If you're in a place like Guangzhou, which is closer to Hong Kong, far away from Beijing, so far away from the sort of center of the spider web, then you have a lot more freedom. People talk more, people share more, and there are more sort of underground mechanisms for getting information out.
Got it.
I'm Dan Jordan. I'm a PhD student in biophysics. I'm really interested, I guess, in the possibilities of cooperation and distributed action for my field and for science and scientific research. Things like the folded protein folding game are really cool applications of
the
stuff to science.
The folding game.
It's called
Fold It.
Yeah.
Folding at home or Fold It.
Fold It is a adaptation of Folding at Home. It's an interactive version where you can actually grab a protein and shake it and try to find and twist it and try to find the best configuration. People can actually do a lot better than scientists in their labs can do with this. All the people on the internet working together have found some really cool solutions.
You guys might need an ad man too, but let's play cytotoxin. And how do we play?
You gotta download it. It's not that easy.
And how fun is it?
When I last tried it was in the spring before it was officially released. So it wasn't a lot of fun then.
It just shows you with a large enough denominator.
Exactly.
Yeah, someone will find it fun.
Mm-hmm. Great. Hi, I'm Sarah Cortez, and I'm an IT consultant, and I mostly build major applications for financial services companies like trading companies. But sometimes I build faculty information systems for Harvard Law School professors. And I am also mainly involved in building a lot of security systems, and I'm involved and interested in the area of where internet forensics for crime solving intersects with interfering with freedom. So that's a topic that I'm interested in.
Internet surveillance.
Exactly, which is used for solving crime, which people like me who are involved in security often become involved in detecting, documenting, and solving crimes. But that those same tools that we use for that can be used for nefarious purposes. So that's a topic I'm interested in.
Thanks. I'm Aaron Shaw. I'm a fellow here at the Berkman Center. I'm also a PhD student at UC Berkeley in sociology. While I'm here, I'm got the task of translating whatever schemes I can cook up with Yokai into tangible, manageable research projects. So every time I open my mouth, I get 15 more hours of work. But that's really probably the best part of my job. In my spare time, I'm very interested in what I consider to be the sort of misgovernance of the internet and information at a global level.
Misgovernance of the internet.
That's what I think it is.
And who's doing the misgoverning?
There are lots of actors involved. There are lots of private interests and governments and nonprofits, all of whom think they have the best way to make things work. And it's hard to coordinate between so many people to produce something that can continue to function as a generative source of innovation and smooth information flow and exchange of ideas. So, yeah.
Hi there, I'm Chris Seguin. I'm a new fellow here. I started yesterday. This is my second day now, and Berkman already got a takedown request for something that I was having on my directory. I'm a blogger for CNET also.
What was in your directory? So let's look at it before it goes away.
If you type in surveillance state, it's a CNET blog that I write. I wrote about a private company that sells surveillance software to really sketchy governments. If you scroll down, you'll see some of those really nice slides. The second one is actually Google Earth, real-time with 50 million Indonesian cell phone numbers. That's real-time location information. And the company didn't particularly like me hosting a copy of their sales pitch on Berkman's server.
For whom they're selling this to government?
They're selling it to any government that will buy it. There's about 5 or 6 different companies in this industry. And my article was looking into the whether this could be used in the U.S. and how the
so
information...
This is a company that will sell to a government.
This is off-the-shelf software that'll do the community of interest, call analysis, link analysis, all this kind of stuff. Not on the contents of the calls, but on where you are and who you're calling and who they're calling.
This company called Thorpe Glen.
And there's a bunch of others in Israel, in India, in Czech Republic, in South Africa. And it's a totally sketchy industry that's not been written about before.
And so the takedown notice?
Was sent to Berkman this morning, I think.
Why to Berkman?
Because I put it on my Berkman directory. An archive of my theory was that they wouldn't send a takedown to a large center of lawyers, but I guess I was wrong.
You just picked a place that has a clinical project.
Right.
So is it linked? It's linked from this blog.
A copy of the these are just 2 slides from the presentation,
yeah.
And a copy of the whole 12 or 14 slides. Sales pitch, there's a mirror on that page, a mirror link that links to the PDF on...
And the presentation is yours or is
it's theirs? It's their sales pitch from their website.
It's their copyrighted sales pitch.
Right. Yes.
Good lawyers.
I think it's totally pressworthy, and I'm writing about surveillance, and I think that if they take this down, that it'll be a detriment to the global discourse.
But you can also get it from their website.
Until they take it down. The story was on Slashdot last night, which is why I thought that they would remove it. So the issue that I'm interested in the future is that of the third-party doctrine and information in the cloud. I feel like people are storing more and more information on Google servers, their calendar, their emails, their documents. And what would traditionally have required a search warrant to obtain can now be obtained with a subpoena. And I feel like the average user doesn't know this yet. There seems to be a market failure in that we don't have privacy-preserving solutions for the end user. Companies offer them, but they don't make them the default. So, for example, everyone in here who uses Gmail, I doubt if more than 10% of the people in the room are using the HTTPS version of Gmail, even though it's available for anyone who chooses to do so.
Pew has a thing coming out. I guess it's not up on their site yet, but it's just about to come out on user attitudes towards cloud computing. So your view is people might not be as scared as they should be.
My view is that people will never be as scared as they should be, and we need to. I think we need tobacco style warnings to motivate companies to default to.
The Surgeon General has determined that cloud computing can be.
Or that someone sitting next to you in Starbucks can read your email. I think that most people don't actually understand the real risks that they're exposed to. So that's why I'm here. I work on security, privacy, and the mix of sort of technology and law.
Well, it's great to have you here.
Thanks.
Hope you're not led away in handcuffs.
Again.
Again.
I'm Adrian Gropper. I'm with a fledgling company called MedCommons. Putting medical records in the cloud, working on medical cooperation, and very much involved in sort of how the guilds, in this particular case, doctors and regulatory agencies, are trying to put the genie back in the bottle.
Got it. Great. Wow, is that everyone? Yes. Thank you. So it's a nicely. Did you say time's up? Is that right? We go till 1:30. We go till 1:45. Says the mistress of ceremonies. Well, 1:45 is fine. No, I thought this would be a great way of actually canvassing the brain trust in this room. As you look at this list. It's interesting to think about what dogs haven't barked and how you might compare it to the list that would have been generated, say, 10 years ago by Digerati in the room. And obviously, we're a self-selected, non-representative group. Privacy didn't rear its head that much. It did sort of towards the very end.
to the extent that it did, you didn't hear a lot about privacy against corporate parties. Nobody's worried so much about cookies in here, or maybe people are worried about it, but don't see it as a cutting-edge issue for 2008, 2009 with new stuff in it. Yochai, as you've been... What's that?
Maybe we just got
over it. We just got over it, just like Scott McNeely said we should. He claims that was mischaracterized, but I'm not sure we believe him. Yochai, as you look at this, what pattern emerges, if any?
Random walk.
Random walk?
Really, this seems random to you guys?
No, I think, I mean, the problem is how to not just bring the same set of assumptions that I've already coming to and just sort of reinterpreting everything in, through my
through your
glasses,
hammer.
Which is
right.
Which is what's hard for anyone. I'd say, you know, the public policy issues, ironic, they're all the public policy issues other than privacy, actually. I mean, I may actually want to push back a little bit. So other than privacy, the question of telecoms regulation, basic access to networks, that is to say, net neutrality spectrum, justice in access, has been there and hasn't really been resolved. Neither is the question of copyright and enclosure of the public domain. Those are still there very much the way they were, let's not say 10 years ago, because 10 years ago was the annus horribilis, but as of 8 or 9 years ago. Filtering, surveillance, censorship, that stuff you were working on 8 years ago, other people have been working on. In some senses, this question of filtering, surveillance, censorship has been since the early 90s, at least,
yeah.
Sort of computer freedom and privacy. I think that the future of old media and new media world is too narrow of a description there. I think one of the things that's up, if you look at Media Cloud that's trying to move to text analysis, if you're looking at the efforts to do qualitative analysis of blogs that Aaron, Victoria, and I are doing. It's an effort to get to another round, but it's really an effort to understand democracy and how it relates, and it's a subset of it is old media. Even freeing up the law, access to court documents, in some senses, this is things. You know, Ethan Katch in 1994 wrote his Law in a Digital World that had a lot around that. So there's a bit of an irony. I mean, the theme is that maybe it means that we're backward looking, or maybe it means that we're, once the fashions flare up and that there's a stable set of considerations. I think the question of cloud computing and a new architecture.
Yeah.
But interestingly, it's not rolling back, except except perhaps with cooperation. Given what we're doing in the law lab, we're trying to also do that within the framework of cloud computing. But actually, it's the stability rather than the instability of the issues that's
right.
Striking to me.
Right. I guess what I see is, if we were looking at this list 10 years ago, it might fit the pattern a lot more of. Crisis and resolution. That's one template for writing any kind of story, book chapter, or academic paper. Here's a problem. Here's what we should do about the problem. And the general template then was, wow, the internet is causing the following problem for people. Here's how we should adapt the law or in some other way try to meet this problem. And a lot of the stuff on this list seems less based on here's the way things were, internet is intruding on it, how do we beat back the hordes? And more, wow, there's some really cool new stuff going on nascently that we could learn from or build more out of. And maybe that's a little bit second generation. Esther?
Yeah, I think another aspect that you could call second generation is that while a lot of these questions have been around, I think we're starting to take more sophisticated approaches to it, among them that we're looking at them empirically, which I don't think was happening to nearly this extent, especially here among a group of lawyers. No offense, it's not, you guys aren't known for... legal scholars are not known for their hardcore empirical work, but it's really exciting to see more and more of that, which is very smart because we seem to do it for like half the pay, so it's very, very smart. But yeah, so that's what, when I look at this list, I think the questions have been around, but I really feel like listening to people talk about the questions and how we're thinking about them sounds like we're relying on much more empirical data.
And this maybe puts you on the spot a little bit, Esther, but what would you say in the past 10 years have been some of the triumphs of empiricism in this field? What has it told us that doesn't merely confirm what we think anecdotally, but that's like, wow, we didn't know that?
Well, I mean, I think generally, I think that's a really big question. I think generally speaking, there are a lot of things that are really easy to state that are really just assumptions and empirical questions. They're extremely complicated to study well empirically. So, I mean, you'd have to get into very specifics, I think, to get at that. I don't think I have a very quick response to that one.
Once upon a time, we thought that the internet would treat censorship as damage and route around it, and that technology would determine the democratization of all of the world, including all of the giants, will collapse. Once upon a little less of a while ago, some people claim. A response to that was fragmentation, nobody would talk to anybody else, you'd get echo chamber and polarization. All of that first decade of claims about the effects, completely opposite claims about the effects of the internet on democracy, were basically pulled out of thin air.
And these are the group of claims you're talking about now are kind of Republic.com style claims?
That's the second round.
That's the second round. Right.
The first round is more sort of the general net libertarianism. Then, starting in 99 and continuing over the course of the uh-ohs, you get link analysis being introduced to look at the way in which actual discourse happens. And we find all sorts of interesting things about which we have lots of different interpretations. And so an example of that just from around here, the Iran blogosphere study that Bruce and John Kelly wrote last year, finding very interesting and surprising patterns of clustering around a more complex structure of the Iranian blogosphere-based public sphere than we had previously thought. So one of the things that happened on this complete freedom versus complete control was a finding that actually what you get is quite substantial concentration. And then my interpretation of reading some of the things was that actually when you got the close enough clusters, you did get some less thin. There's other work, Matthew Hindeman, Henry Farrell, Dresner, that did another interpretation and another cut. Then you've got Esther's look, which then takes link analysis and builds on top of it also content analysis done by hand coding of the kind of content. And then goes back and says, well, actually, we see a certain kind of disconnect, but at the same time, we actually don't see polarization in the sense of more extreme views over time.
Yeah.
If you're looking at the generation of what we're trying to do now, it's trying to move beyond link analysis to using a lot more text and a lot more both machine processing of language, which was what MediaCloud is supposed to do, and starting to look more at governance structures. So the thing that one of the things that I'm doing with Aaron and Victoria, for example, is looking at the left and right wing blogospheres and the way in which they're organized. Maybe we'll see. Waiting for the numbers. coding done. in the ways in which they're different. In which case, the whole question of internet effect on democracy, as opposed to, well, it's a cluster of technologies. It gets mapped on a cluster of cultural practices. And lo and behold, there's not one effect.
Yeah.
So I think that, in that regard, I completely agree with Esther, that sort of calming down, a little less crisis, and I completely like your way of thinking that it's not calming down, systemization of the study, systemization of the response, moving from being amazed at the fact that you've got all of this collaboration happening to being, okay, amazed, but how do I make this thing work? And how do I build systemization? And does actually the spontaneity and collaboration survive systemization? Or do we get corruption through corporate structuring of collaboration? These are in some senses more mature, or questions that reflect a more mature stage, both of the set of practices and of the set of observations.
Yeah.
But that sounds extremely unexciting.
To follow up on briefly, so even within the empirical investigation, it seems like there are definitely layers of sophistication. So there's the initial excitement. I mean, one way in which things have definitely gotten more sophisticated is that we have, first of all, access to these volumes of data and log data of all sorts, and then you have people who are sophisticated in the methods of dealing with those, basically data mining. But it's rather rare that you have the social scientist with the social scientist background, with the theories, with the substantive questions, come at the data, working with someone who has the technical part and working together to look at the data. So the first run of the data analysis tends to be more the people who don't really get the social science questions or the substantive questions are just wowed by the pictures generated and don't realize that's not necessarily telling us much. Whereas what Yohai just talked about, that now you take both the log data, but then you also start to look more deeply at what those data are. So that's sort of, I think, a next level of sophistication in dealing with the data.
Now, one question that might help bring this in for a broader landing. When you gather data, when you do the mining of the data, this kind of data that's gathered here, which is basically gathered by scraping a bunch of blogs, right? There's blogs posted or run on various content management platforms, but you scrape them, you see what's linking to what, and before you know it, you've got the kind of picture that gets you started on your next round. If the robots.txt for a given site says, please, I don't want to be scraped, stay out, do you respect that as a researcher, or do you scrape right along?
Yeah, so I should say I've never done a project that actually does automatic scraping, so not something personally I can address.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if someone more technical would know whether you can you even just ignore it?
Just a request to say no
okay,
trespassing
well
sign with no shotgun behind it.
That's a very good question back to the research ethics part, right?
Yeah.
How people deal with that. I don't actually collect data this way.
And the thing that actually to me links it to a broader question is, Yohai, when you talk about corporate consolidation and umbrella over activities, one trend that might be happening now that wasn't so present over the past anarchic 10 years was a lot of the social activity starting to be brought under corporate mediated roofs. So there's a whole bunch of stuff going on Facebook.
Yeah, you can, right.
There's lots of stuff you might be
Absolutely.
Tempted to study, but either the data is simply not available unless you could persuade Facebook to part with it, although you know they are mining it, you know, six ways from Sunday. And if you try to scrape your way through, that's a violation of the Facebook terms of service, even if the individuals whose profiles were being looked at wouldn't mind at all.
And they have sent cease and desist letters to colleagues of mine.
Yeah.
They really, really do not like people scraping their system. And, you know, as opposed to MySpace, for example, which, while it's against their terms of service, you can still scrape it.
Not sure I would attribute that to a liberal philosophy as much as incompetence.
Well,
by MySpace.
The clear difference between the two sites, right, is that with Facebook, you have to create a user ID and then scroll through the terms of service before you can scrape the data, whereas MySpace lets you see it before you see the terms of service. So Facebook, by the design of their system, ties you far more strongly to their terms of service.
Yeah. That's just it's something that could change in an hour. Is a strange thread to hang the difference on, but I
actually is a future big issue, and something I know, for example, MacArthur is trying to deal with as well. Just this question of access to data and access to our own data, but also access for researchers to data. Government sponsors big projects, but tremendous amounts of data are now available more and more through private companies, and there isn't really a way for researchers to get access to those data. And that's a really huge challenge.
But to me, then, one of the biggest changes from past maybe to future is we've been through an era in which so much of the activity we've generated or been focusing on as consumers, as people, when we look at the web, when we build on the web, is in the category of what I call collective hallucination. Like, the web itself is a collective hallucination. It's a series of servers that just so happen to speak the same protocol, stitched together by third parties who choose to crawl it and offer a service also on the web called Google that you can use to figure out what's on the web in competition with other search agencies. As it consolidates more and more this activity into a handful of aggregated enterprises like Facebook, or not just content, but applications under the iPhone rubric or the Facebook apps rubric, you see not only new opportunities for control and fewer opportunities for measurement and figuring out where we're going, but basically an end to the hallucination, and now it's just a very real thing. Facebook is, in fact, a set of software running on a single server, not so hallucinatory. And when I look at our first set of questions about cooperation and distributed action, to me it's how to take up the ongoing invitation of the collective hallucination of the internet and the web, to build on it, to invite people to your corner of it, to do stuff together, while that is still a commonplace thing to do. Because my own concern is, maybe this fits into crisis and resolution mode, it's becoming less and less commonplace. And I'm known, this is a terrible bumper sticker, but as, how did you put it, Wolf? A guy who hates the iPhone. I love my iPhone, don't get me wrong. I think it's delicious. It's like warm bread.
I'm like also, a good cigarette is what you mean.
It's like a good cigarette.
Eventually
exactly.
They'll kill you.
Mentholated at that. And it's the prospect that this is so good that it actually becomes a model for all our technology, not just a cell phone, because if I'm complaining about cell phones, I might as well complain that the refrigerator is not generative. There's no add-ons to my Amana. It's like Cry Me a River. But I think this is a model for how our PCs, how our web, how our other major interactions can start to look, in part because it's so damn attractive and successful. So anyway, I know we're at time. I'm so excited about the coming year. I hope we'll have many opportunities to gather like this, share in depth a lot of the issues, and maybe have a chance to flesh this out a little more, see what we're missing, and be able to delve in deeper to the stuff that's fractal. So with that, thanks again. Let us mingle. There's still plenty of desserts up front. So thank you all.